Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Deep Thoughts. This is a special report, an extension report on the Mandela Effect. I've seen enough. This world is not what you think it is. This reality is not as iced down as you think it is. We're living in some joke. We're living in something that isn't as serious as we think it is. We are like several steps above a normal dream, I would say. Had a guy post on the site this morning something that just blew my fucking mind to pieces. You know, the Berenstain Bears, well, I now completely acknowledge that for you guys. I know I can. But that's something that, you know, you just bumped into, you experienced, no one took you aside in a classroom and said, this is how it's spelled, kids, and then you remember it. So people can contest that, even though you know it was a different way. Because now I believe it was a different way, for some of you at least. But this dude just blew my fucking mind this morning. Now, after I completed the episode, one of you guys posted that you were raised in Australia, that you live there today, I believe, and that New Zealand was always on the west coast, off the west coast of Australia, which is how I was raised. I have a photographic memory when I need one, and that's how I remember it. And now I look on the map and it's on the southeast side, like Madagascar is for Africa, which I never knew where Madagascar was. By the way, Madagascar is actually interesting to look at on Google Maps. But what this dude posted this morning is something I remember extremely specific because it had irony. It had massive irony, and it was something I just never, ever forgot. It was burned in my memory, and I didn't have any interest in history as a kid. I was just, no teacher was smart enough to say, hey kids, if you don't, you know, all the things that are bad in the world, if we don't learn why those things happen, we're going to repeat them again. No one ever said that. I mean, all the teachers sucked. Just teaching out of books. God bless them. The cotton gin. The cotton gin was raised to me with irony, and I remember this dude's face. I remember his face. I'm going to see if I can draw it, but I probably can't do any justice, right? Because it's sort of an apparition thing in front of me. Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin. Unless there's been some cruel, intentional joke in this hardcore reality, shit just changed, people. Eli Whitney was taught to me as a huge historical irony that a black man who had to pick cotton every single day, back-breaking work, right? That dude invented the cotton gin to end the fucking game. To end the game and say, we're not picking any more cotton. You're going to use this machine called the cotton gin. I remember the teacher saying, did you know a black man invented the cotton gin? I remember the last 30 years of my life, black activists talking about all the great black men in the world, black women in the world, and he's always mentioned. I remember this vividly over and over and over, but I remember the day they taught him in class. I don't remember what day it was, but I remember thinking, whoa, how weird, because I feel the pain. I always felt the empathetic pain of slavery, you know, to some minor degree. I felt the empathetic pain of the suffering of the Native Americans, and here I am sitting on their land, and we go to Indian reservations, and these guys look at us like we're, you know, total assholes, even though I'm a little kid. I can't take it away from them. But when I remember Eli Whitney being a black man that invented the cotton gin. Now it's a white guy who graduated from Yale. And what is the irony that it goes to Yale, the skull and bones harbor of the world? I don't think you can just flip it in the history books. Because then everybody would remember Eli Whitney's a black guy. So does this kid, or guy. Sorry, I do not mean to say that. I always think I'm an old man, so I always say kid. As soon as this guy posts on the YouTube that Eli Whitney is a white guy, I make phone calls to my friends and I say, Mandela effect. I say, do you remember the guy who invented the cotton gin? Yes. I said, tell me one attribute about that guy that you remember. First thing out of their mouths is black guy. Every call I made, black guy. And I start laughing and I just say, look, the world isn't what you think it is. This isn't what we think it is. And you know what? I don't think it takes itself as seriously as we take it. I don't think I have any soldiers. I don't think I'm that lucky to have a soldier deployed over in Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere in the Middle East. But I want you to, if you can pass this to somebody over there, let's do this together. As you're sitting out there, depending on what you remember, especially, and who knows when this thing flips, right? Who knows if it flips in 96 and every kid who's in war doesn't remember because they're 18 to 20 years old. It's always been the white guy from Yale. But there's a single boy or girl out there deployed who thinks it was a black guy who invented the cotton gin. And you're sitting there and you're contemplating someone telling you to fight a war, and you got to fight a war and you got to do this thing. I'm not saying don't do your job, but think about it. If the guy who invents the cotton gin can be flipped in a Mandela effect in this universe, what are we doing? What are we doing taking this shit so seriously? It seems as if the fabric of the universe itself ebbs and flows. And somehow there's a clan of us that come from the same origin. And we flow into this universe. And I don't know if the people that we replace go back to our universe. But something's up. Because it seems as if there's a giant portion of people that remember it the way it is today, perceivably. And there's a bunch of us that remember the way it was. This guy posts on Facebook or YouTube, excuse me, this post. He also had a question of whether or not the stoplights had green on the bottom or red on top. I always remembered a green on bottom myself because I've drawn them a lot as a kid. My first illustrations were of cop cars. But isn't it weird how it selectively modulates for all of us? Right? It's not just, here's the universe in state A, and we go to state B. It's, no, this sector of the world, which has New Zealand on the left side, that some of you are going to now experience it on the right side. It's just like the movie Dark City, where we individually get tuned. We individually move around. Now, I did the Mandela Effect episode a long time ago, and I believe it was due to a suggestion from someone. So I don't remember everything I talked about. I remember some of it, and Sex and the City and all this stuff. But for me, I want to remind in this episode, or go for it, which is, what was the mechanism of the movie Dark City? I know I mentioned this. You have to go to sleep, and when you go to sleep, we get tuned. Well, what would be the most opportune time to make this Mandela effect happen? It would be when we're not conscious. But look how multidimensional it is. That you can experience some things differently and other things not differently. And let me just, you know, if they modified it in the books, like I said, they modified in the books, then everyone would remember a black guy, and then maybe just a certain line in the sand in terms of age, there'd be a new generation that would believe it's a white Yale guy. And, you know, there's a lot of things. All history used to be like this back in the, you know, 1,000 years ago. It was always white guys discovering everything, and it was always aristocratic oligarchy offspring that would always usurp everything, which is why Darwin should not get any credit for his shitty interpretation of de Lamarck's stuff. A peasant figured out evolution and epigenetics, right? As I've said several times on the show. So, taking it out of the hands of a black man and putting it in the hands of a similarly named person from Yale, well, even Wikipedia would have the alteration in its records. you know, unless Wikipedia's in on it, but someone would have a book, okay, that I read when I was a kid, because there was no internet. We didn't see it in an overlay projection. We saw it in a book. So someone had that history book in this realm, and we just pull out and go, see, look, it's a black dude. I remember his regal outfit. I remember his hair. He kind of had this groomed, you know, afro. I remember him. It's weird. I don't know, there's other black inventors that I could be confusing it with, but the irony, I just remember it was probably one of the first times that I really understood irony in my life and didn't know what it was called. But there it was. But what I mentioned about dreams, because I want to, you know, there's two types of ways we can talk about things. I prefer a latter, which is rare, very rare. Now, I utterly respect this first method of communication, but it's very debilitating, and I think it's actually, well, I just think it's debilitating. Let's just put it that way. We're talking about something scientific, such as the Mandela effect, and what do? We pussyfoot around the fact that we can't find proof of what the hell we're saying. I can't prove to you that Eli Whitney was a black guy when I was young. I can't, other than to lament in great detail what school I was in, who my teacher was, when I got taught this stuff, so on and so forth. And so if you were to have this conversation on YouTube and there was, you know, a great level of scrutiny on you about proving what you say, you're going to have some blowhard like, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson walk in and say, well, you know, I'm prove it. As long as you prove it, like, we can get in this conversation. And then we pussyfoot around what we're observing. And then there's the second way of conversating about it, which is just to simply acknowledge it and really change our perception of reality based on what we're seeing. And that's going to be my style, probably for the rest of my life. I think it takes very little courage to do the first level, first style of communication. I think it takes all your courage to communicate in the second level. We have this companion website we did for several years before the show. MK Ultra Radio, which we barely get a chance to record anymore, way before Deep Thoughts. It's called onepagenews.com. It's still there. Go to MKUltraRadio.com. The link is at the top. But we wrote probably 360 plus articles. Some of them are just regurgitating videos that we really liked. I go back every once in a while and cruise through the old posts and delete them because videos have been turned off. And it is amazing how many great videos out there that get turned off because the whole channel gets turned off. Either somebody gets spooked or, I don't know. I don't know why you wouldn't just leave it up there. However, I mean, if you change your opinion, like I might change my opinion about most of my deep thoughts and then eventually turn the channel off because it's just not who I am anymore. But I'm more apt to replace old episodes and redo them if I feel like they suck. You know, my vision right now is to get to 100. And then go back and look at all the episodes that I've ever done, listen to them, and redo the ones that I think really are shabby. For the ones that don't look as attractive, I'm going to pull them down, re-edit them, and post them back up, remastered. It'll destroy all my stats, but who gives a shit? I just want to make it sort of an encyclopedia of thought. Then I'll move on to the next show, whatever that's going to be. Though, in onepagenews.com, we wrote articles that we believed were based on utter truth. And it served us well. We didn't pussyfoot around what could be and what couldn't be. We just made predictions because we believed we understood the truth. And we wrote articles, and God damn it if they didn't totally pan out. From presidential election predictions to corporate eventualities. I think one of the most profound articles you're going to read at onepagenews.com years before it happens is when Apple eventually tanks and Google buys them. You're going to read that article. That's going to be 10 years before it happened that we saw and we knew this was this is just where it is. Right? You have a company that when Steve Jobs dies in 2011 November, I think November, it's worth nearly $1 trillion market cap. And what do? They put a guy in charge that has no technical background whatsoever. No charisma whatsoever. Absolutely Al Gore plus a robot plus Big Gay Al, and you got Tim Cook. And sure, he has an appeal on some microscopic demographic level, but he has no appeal when it comes to refining products and bringing them to greatness. And any board of directors that knee-jerks him into position and doesn't replace him eventually is operating under orders to destroy that company. Exactly what happened when Apple got up the first time and started kicking IBM's ass. Infiltrated by, was it Scully, or his name was? Destroyed the company, handed it off to Emilio, destroyed the company even further, like we couldn't figure it out. And now, you know, the last mantra of Steve Jobs was to say, I'm going to use all the money to destroy Google. And of course, he said that about IBM, and IBM won. And so now, and Microsoft took off. So now it's all Google. Google's going to take over the planet. So we reported things based on just overwhelming circumstantial evidence, and we've been right. So with this Mandela effect thing, the reason why I digressed into that was to say, you guys have now converted me. 100%. 100%. So let's start talking from the point in this little special report about how we should live our lives based on the fact this Mandela effect appears to be 100% correct. Because for me, for the rest of my life, it's 100% correct until someone figures out a way to explain it to me. But I've been putting a lot of thought into dreaming. I have a whole episode on dreaming. But I tell you what, one of the coolest things about doing a show like this is, one, you get to take all the subjects that you're very interested in and lament about them for an hour plus, and you get to harvest people of similar minds to listen to your show, and then you just go back and forth, just like this guy that blew me away this morning. Okay. Then when you run out of subject matter, you've got to go and think of new subjects. And if you've done a good job in the first episodes, then you're really interested in making sure your next episodes are good. That's why I've recorded without a doubt 10 episodes that I've thrown away over the year. Over the year I've done this, it's not even been a year. You know, I lost probably at least 2 to technical difficulties. I lost one the other day to a technical difficulty. I could just kill myself. I forgot to plug my machine in. I went too fast. I was so excited about the subject, I don't even remember what it was. But I plugged in and talked about a bunch of shit, and then boom, I look over my computer and I'm like, son of a bitch. Because I got my laptop off to the side here, and I've got it set so it doesn't sleep the monitor if it's plugged in. So if I look over and it's black, something went wrong. But how do we live our life now? I'm going to suggest something about dreaming, because I think it's true. Dreaming is imposed on us by our creators. I'm starting to think this is a simulation of some sort. And it doesn't mean that this is a matrix, but maybe it is. I just don't know if our other state of being is like the matrix when Neo gets out. You know, humanoid bodies and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if I said it, but I may have said this before, but they always say that the eyes are the window to the soul, right? And they are. You want to test this theory out? Let me give you a little homework for you that you're going to enjoy. Next time you get in a room with other individuals, it's best if it's a casual one. I was having this conversation with a buddy of mine named Richard at my smoke shop. And Richard's across from me. It's just the two of us in this room watching some TV, but it's sort of quiet. And I started talking about the window of the soul thing, and he totally gets me. He's 62 years old. And I think he's looking at me, and I said, think about it. I said, I can look at your chest. I can look at your knees. I can look at your boots. I can look at your head, the top of your head. And I'm looking at you, but I don't feel any super connection to you until I look in your eyes. And the second I look into your eyes, all of a sudden, it's as if the extension cords come together. Boom. And electricity fires, and I'm now looking at another sentient being, and there's an alarm feeling in my chest that I've made eye contact with someone. You know, little kids, they have to learn how to make eye contact. You have to teach your kids how to make eye contact. But I always told little kids, I said, look, if you're nervous about looking someone in the eyes, if it freaks you out, then look at their nose. Look at their forehead. They won't know the difference. But it'll get you kind of practicing to look at someone's face. And it really doesn't matter if you keep that habit up your whole life and just don't tell anybody. But that's the way I started when I was a kid. But if this is a simulation, and there's any sort of real material instrumentalities that we use, meaning a body, then the thing that I believe that is punching through from that world to this world is our eyes. Our eyes. Well, that's a horrible thing to have to say. But I think that the eyes are part of the real construction of who we are because of that amazing connection. If nothing else, there's something in the mechanical physics, mechanical spirituality of our existence by which when we do look in the eyes of another human being, it is magical. If you've ever been in love with another human being and you lay them down on a bed, you just happen to be the one on top, and you look down in their eyes, you can tell whether or not you're with an empathetic soul that you should probably spend your life with if you look at them and they appear to understand what's going on. I apologize for talking about these people I date. I feel horrible. Hopefully I'm not, you know, over the long run, hopefully I'm not throwing them over the coals because I've only dated amazing people. Everybody's human. I don't blame anybody for anything. But I dated this girl, absolutely gorgeous woman. But she was very, very strong-willed during the day. And I like a strong woman. That's just my thing. And we would get into the bedroom. And before anything got saucy, okay, we're not there yet. Don't worry, I'm not going there. But we'd lay on the bed because we're tired. But I get on top of her every once in a while, and we'd have a conversation, right? I'm just like on top of her. And I remember this incredibly, incredibly matriarchal woman who loved to run the show during the day, although she said she wanted a guy to run the show. She really didn't want that, but it's like, a woman, I can run the show, trust me. But I let her do it because that's what she was really good at, and I just love to see a woman be strong. It's cool. It's rare. But when I got on top of her and looked her in the eye, she just would turn to jelly. She turned into this cute, extremely docile, feminine version of herself, and it was just a wonderful transformation. I remember seeing her transform in front of me made me transform. But it was all about the eye contact. As soon as the eye contact got really sincere, she transformed. And it was I miss it to this day. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But I have also got with girls where I think there's this amazing moment going on, and I look in their eyes, whether or not we're sitting at a beach or on top of each other or whatever, and they just don't do anything. It's like they're these non-player characters I talked about in the simulation model. And so you gotta take inventory of that kind of stuff. But this is about the Mandela effect. So let's just say that, again, I'm mentioning that because I believe there's evidence of a simulation and that the eyes have this profound effect on our spiritual communication and connection. I said in my other episode that I think maybe we're all a bunch of sticky neurons on the plane of consciousness. I think that's a great metaphor, because neurons exist in our simulated world based on the laws of mathematics and attraction. Well, why wouldn't that mathematic repeat itself in the spiritual realm? At least that one mathematic. Something like it, you know? What's beautiful about neurons is they are sort of a parent-child entity. A child is created by the parent neuron being overwhelmed with electricity. If you haven't seen all my episodes, my theory on this, and no one's ever lamented this, but this is my reason for why your brain pattern grows. A neuron has a fixed amount of electricity that it is supposed to endure, and when it gets overwhelmed to a certain point, a trigger goes off in its genetic code and its protein patterns that says we're now operating at peak capacity or above peak capacity, so it's time to multiply. And so we know the way a neuron multiplies is it throws part of its nucleus out into the brain cavity, and all of the neighboring village people village neurons, they all donate the coaxial cellular tissue to protect the nucleus out in the volatile world of the brain, and in doing so, they all reach out a neural connection to the new child neuron, keeping a connection from all different angles. Everyone who helps that cell, all the neurons that help that cell gain its coaxial protection layer, then have a coaxial protection conduit to it, and you have a brain that grows. But here's the key. If you do not use your brain, and if you do not overwhelm your neurons with electricity by thinking, not memorizing and repeating, right? That shit doesn't make your neurons go at all. But learning, getting tired, like I said in last episode, you are not going to increase the density of your brain. But here's the beautiful thing. When you do increase the density of your brain, it's almost as if you were hit by an alien ray and you are simply smarter the next day. The amount of information you can take in at one moment is more. The amount that you can process is more. And life's chaos seems to be less of chaos. You know, anthropologists that study hominids and the missing link, they have proven to us beyond the shadow of a doubt that a lot of our brain cavity has been genetically turned off. Our visual cortex is, 10 times as complex as the part of our visual cortex that we use. It's 5 layers of cheese, those little squares of cheese that you buy at the store, right? It's 5 layers of that, and we only use half a layer, which means, you know, 1/10. Because every slice would be 20% of your visual cortex at 5 layers. So there's a genetic code that stops us before the first 10%. So something came in and took primate, made one branch that was hominid, that howls like a Bigfoot. You know, we call them apes. Some people think, you know, they did exist, these big Neanderthals and what have you, but the we got articulated skull redesign, right? But here's my thing with Mandela Effect. I think this happens when we dream. I think dreaming nowadays, I don't know how much I've shared this, so let me just share it from scratch. This is a special report, who gives a shit? I believe that dreaming is where the tuning happens. And I believe that whoever wrote Dark City, which I haven't looked it up, somehow tapped into this consciousness. I don't know if we're, you know, run by aliens on a square disc. I mean, a circular disc. Square disc. When you ever put those two words together? Apparently right now. But it was like a little tiny sub-metaphor of what might be going on. Square disc that we're all living on. You know. And when I finally studied the precession thing, I'm going to share a little bit of the Flat Earth 2 thing. So there's all these videos about precession and gyroscopes, and they're fucking awful. These nerds can't make a point to save their soul. They just keep cutting and pasting all these old videos proving to you how gyroscopes work for hours and hours and hours and never just make a very simple point. And the simple point about gyroscopes proving that we're on a flat something or other is that once you spin a gyroscope that's inside of two independent axis circles, right? I mean, if you spin a gyroscope and it's straight up and down to your top of your head and the bottom of your head, and you start rotating the thing, you know already, because you played with one when you were a kid, the thing stays straight up, no matter how you rotate it, because that's the way a gyroscope works. It's not based on Earth's gravitational force. It's based on the centripetal and centrifugal combination of force. My physics teacher always says centrifugal doesn't exist, but the centripetal force of vectors pulling in to a circular thing like that, which is a gyroscope. And that's why it stays stationary. It is absolutely positively localized in its gravitational force and does not cower down to the Earth's gravitational pull. We've seen this a million times in experiments. Okay. So you're at the North Pole and you spin a gyroscope inside your plane, and you got a gauge on your dashboard that's telling you how it's spinning, telling you the orientation of your plane relative to the ground. If you fly from the North Pole to the equator on one day, one journey, or anything like that, from north to south, on a latitudinal line, you should see the gyroscope stay level with the North Pole. And as you go down to the equator, even though you are now perpendicular to the side of the Earth, the gyroscope in front of you should be left and right instead of top to bottom, because it's still aligned with the North Pole when you where you took off. But all these pilots have now confirmed that precession, this mechanism by which the gyroscope stays centered to where it was started, it doesn't change at all. It's still up and down at the equator, and when it should be left and right, because it should rotate. It should put it this way. It actually won't rotate at all, and you're rotating around it, which is what happens with a gyroscope. So the gyroscope should change, and it doesn't. That's basically it. So when you spin at the North Pole and you fly to the equator, it should be like this. Not like this. You start at the equator like this, or start at the North Pole like this, and when you fly to the equator, it should be rotating like this until it's sideways. Because you have changed your perspective. It's like you held it in your hand and you turned it. But you turning is you turning on the surface of the planet, but we don't see any of that, so we're on a flat something or other. What do you do with science, man? That's Neil deGrasse Tyson losing the argument right there. But what if the greatest thing, and you know, I mentioned in the law of attraction thing, I don't think I mentioned the dream correlation. So let me give you my personal dream correlation with the law of attraction. What if the greatest gift in the universe is falling asleep? And when you fall asleep, it is your time to disengage from this particular book plane of existence, right? Remember, you take the booking theory of the universe, which is every page in the book is a plane of existence, and you're in one split second, and then the next second you could be in a different plane of existence. Maybe planes are organized infinitely dense based on time, whatever. But in the end, you go to sleep, and based on your frequency, when you're asleep, as you approach sleep, which is why you must, that's why they say never go to bed angry with your spouse or your boyfriend, girlfriend. And maybe that's part of it. Maybe if you go to bed angry against your spouse, you tune yourself to a very bad eventuality with that particular spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend, partner. But what if this is the beautiful ecosystem of the way it works? And sometimes, something odd happens. We travel a long distance from where we started. And Eli Whitney goes from being a black guy that makes the cotton gin to a white guy. Now, based on the way that United States of America was and the world was when Eli Whitney was a black guy, I'm thinking I need to get back to the black guy world. Seems like a really good plot for a movie, doesn't it? Let's make a movie called The Mandela Effect. Here we go. I'm going to throw something out there to be ripped off, because I certainly don't want to write this film. But a character gets into the Mandela Effect. We start throwing the story around. And he comes up with the theory. I'm just riffing this off the top of my head. But he creates a wall where every single day he recites to himself all the things that have flipped. From Mandela being dead, Dr. Ruth, the sex therapist, having passed away, now she's alive again, on and on and on down the line. And he memorizes it in his own vehicle. He memorizes it, the time capsule of all truth. He memorizes it. Eli Whitney used to be a black guy, now he's a white guy. And then maybe he rigs up some computers to look up that information on the, Wikipedia or something every morning, to verify what these entities are called, whether or not they're alive or dead. And he just has this theory that eventually, maybe, these soft spots, the Berenstain argument, one of these things might flip back. But he doesn't just randomly wait for it. He thinks about it. He thinks about wanting to go back to the world where it was sort of a better place. And he just waits until the one day it happens. And that's the premise of our story. Not the story of the story. The story would probably be that it's sort of like Close Encounters and Richard Dreyfuss, where Richard has seen a UFO. His wife is sort of the shallow bimbo, but she's supportive and nice. His kids are kids. And he's trying to say, I got to chase this thing down. I'm seeing pyramids everywhere. and this cone shaped thing, which is going to be Devil's Tower or something like that. I think that's what it's called, Wyoming or something, right? And so he probably has a spouse or something. See, probably a young guy, right? Either he's early married or he's dating someone, living with someone, and he starts just getting absolutely enamored with this thing. But he also discovers new ones. Maybe even joins a society of Mandela Effect Society. Maybe he's in New York City where they got a good dense population. Didn't have to travel that far to get to these clubs. It's always sexier in New York City when you have that kind of thing than LA. LA is so massive. I just can't even tell you. New York and San Francisco, you could just jump on a subway and get to where you're going for free practically. In LA, it's like 35 miles one way, and it might take you an hour and a half. You know, it just depends on what kind of time of day you got to go. But somehow he proves it to himself. But he uses sleep to pull it off. He figures it out. We put the sleep idea in there. But let's come back to us for a split second. And let's think, what would we do different about our lives? If we just simply go, look, I remember, I mean, I'd be interested in any of you guys to think that Eli Whitney was a white guy when you were a kid and you're, say, over 40. I'm 46. So Eli Whitney back in the 70s was a black dude. And here's the thing. I grew up in the Midwest, and Kansas was actually really good about racism and that we barely had any. So I'm proud about that, but I don't think there was a lot of, like I think I've said before, we had four black families, probably about four Mexican families, no Indian, no Asian, definitely no Arabic nations. We didn't have any Canadians, you know. Part of our foreigners was a guy from Oklahoma, you know, a white guy from Oklahoma. But to teach that the guy who created the cotton gin is a black guy was a big deal. It was like, really? Wow. Because it was sort of teaching equality in one way or another. That's why it just made such an impression on me. I all I can say is I can definitely tell you that Eli Whitney being a black guy, I mean, you're never going to forget who created the cotton gin after this episode. I see his name so many times. It just hit me on so many levels. And, you know, I wasn't raised with racism, and then I had to even out my racism. I've said it a couple times in the show. On the east side of Main Street, we had this family called the Williamsons. Irma had this barbecue place with Roy, her husband. And it was the best food in town. People traveled 100 miles to see him. So it was like, they were eccentric to me. I was like, oh my God. It's like Egyptians, man. Like they don't build pyramids, but they make the best barbecue on planet Earth. And they had sort of that molasses barbecue, which is, for me, a lot better. It's got that twang to it. It's got that salt, savory thing to it. Just a bit of sweetness to it. My God. I couldn't even believe it. They lived into their 90s, and which was, they passed away in the first decade of this century, and I didn't know they lived 8 miles from my hometown. I would have driven to see them. Why? I never asked. I think I was told that they passed away or something and moved away or something, and I just never thought I had an access to them. But I don't know. This particular one's huge. But let's say we live our lives and wake up every day and it's different now. We can no longer take where we are for granted, that we're on some heliocentric ball, that the reality is hardcore. It doesn't change. Now think about all the mythos that we've ever been taught. You know, the Egyptians have hawk-headed people and anteater-headed people, and we have all these mixed humanoid animal things. It's almost like the Egyptians were the ultimate Plum Island. Somehow, either the gods came down as these hybrid creatures, or someone took the indigenous animals of this world and mixed them with humans until we get, you know, animal-headed people, and these people saw them and just simply drew them. It seems odd to me that a human race would make up stories about half animal, half human. That's really creative, isn't it? Isn't that super duper creative that someone would create that story? But here's the thing. You might say, well, today we don't have any of those, so they definitely didn't exist in the past. You have stories of elves and dwarfs and halflings and ogres and trolls. Maybe they existed. You know, maybe your dwarfs were more of your dwarven genetics. But maybe dwarfism, which can wreak havoc on a human body. You know, dwarfism is very life-threatening because the organs grow as what do they call it, the average people. What do they call us? It's not normal. It's average, right? Something like that. But their internal organs get large, their bodies don't, and that wreaks havoc on their health. But maybe there wasn't. Maybe there's a whole race of dwarfs that didn't co-mingle with the, you know, the taller folks, and they were perfectly fine. They're just really small. And once we started co-mingling sexually, we started impregnating them with kids that were going to get large hearts and with small bodies, and it caused a big problem. And maybe some of our genetics in average people, we have smaller organs for some reason. I don't know. Just speculating. But if this reality is tunable and we are our own sovereign beings, there's got to be a reason why someone else remembers this the way I remember it. Those of you who have your other Mandela effects that you remember, and other people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, remember what you remember. Like, I wasn't raised with Berenstain or Berenstein. It's just not my thing. No one in my circles ever mentioned it. Meaning I have no memory of either one of them. And maybe that is my past. Maybe in my past there was no Berenstain. Either way, I don't know. But we seem to be tuning together in groups. But I would imagine that, you know, for like in like Sex in the City and Sex, was it Sex in the City and Sex and the City? Come on, I just think that's not our best example of the Mandela effect. Not that anyone's protesting, but I would go after New Zealand, its placement on a map. Berenstain, that's pretty good. Eli Whitney for me is like, holy shit. I know I'm obsessing on that, but damn. This morning when I called my friends and they all said black guy, and I said, I hate to break it to you, but I grew up in that past too, and it's a white guy now. What's really weird is, you know, one of my friends had their mind blown, and the other one was just kind of like, ha ha ha, okay, I got to go back to work now. Isn't that weird? How is it people can't stop their day for a split second to have their mind blown? But now, what if this is a tool? What if this is an evidence of a tool and a process that we can use to our advantage? Here's, I think, one thing I want to leave you with today, which is law of attraction plus Mandela effect plus dreaming goes something like this. And I know you've already deduced this, but let's just make it a conscious protocol for ourselves. You need to get into law of attraction. You need to paint the reality that you want, and I mean make it as fanciful as you want it to be. I don't care if you particularly want aliens to show up out of nowhere and deliver the alien promise of cures to everything. Be careful with that one, I would say, because you probably can't imagine an accurate representation of aliens on this planet. I would go for a big car, a nice house, happy wife and kids. Whatever you want. But let's get that vision in your brain. Your B destination point. And when you struggle with having faith that this system really works, think about the Mandela effect. Think about this shit is real. So now when you go to bed at night and when you live your day throughout your day, I want you to think about the fact that this is the way the world works. You've had a conversation with God, and that obviously is not me. It's the culmination of all of God's work in front of you. And if you're not religious, just think about it as a scientific reality. But you now have proof, I think, that we control this mother. We control where we are and when we are in the universe. Meaning when we get our dreams. It's not 10 years from now. If you're suffering from an illness, I know we've got some listeners that are struggling with things from time to time. Well, there you go. Your B is to be healthy and happy. But don't just sell yourself short saying, I got cancer, I'm not going to have cancer. I know that's going to be the immediate focus, but let's just add to that a euphoric destination point. Not only do you not have cancer, but you are where you want to be. You have the job you want. You got the spouse you want, the kids you want, whatever, or none of the above. And then let's go to bed at night with the full understanding and full faith in that system that regardless of how much we travel in our dreams, which is probably just technically proportional to our faith in that belief system, that we'll get there. We'll get a hell of a lot closer every day. But eventually, you always reach your destination. I've never ridden a bike a really long distance, like a really 100-mile distance. I've never done it. But I remember growing up in Kansas, and when I would drive from my little hometown to the next city over, Wichita, Kansas, it was about 104 miles, I think. And I would routinely pass people from other countries and from the United States of America on 10 speeds, long-range bikes with full backpacks on their back, full camping gear, everything. And I know they're going to Wichita, but I think they're also going across the United States of America on some incredible journey. And I actually envy their insight at this point, because I think they did it when they were young enough to really pull it off without a problem. And if I try to do that today, holy hell, I probably need a week or a month to recover from it, right? But they do it. And obviously, they're looking at a 104-mile sign, and they're probably going, oh, geez. But the more they do it, it's not a big deal. 104 miles, yeah. This is part of the marathon. This is what I do, right? That's the attitude we need to have when we go to bed at night. But I'll tell you what. There's honestly no... Well, put it this way. I was in my car. I didn't have any fear. And in less than 2 hours, I'm going to be at my destination because I have a car. Going a lot faster. And I'm going to be air-conditioned. It's going to be a nice, smooth ride. Why don't we envision sleeping as being in a rocket ship? But I will say this, it's okay to go slower too, because you have more experiences along the way that might be really divine. You know, I would put it this way, I've always wanted more kids. I don't know if I'll ever get that chance again. Now, if someone said to me, wizard comes up to me and goes, hey dude, I can wave a magic wand and you're gonna wake up, you're gonna be right on this patio. And within seconds, your kids are going to be inside the house, making a shit ton of noise, having a blast, and your wife's going to be coming home from the store or from work or whatever. Will you take it? You're going to miss getting your wife pregnant. You're going to miss the whole 9 months of carrying all of the children. You're going to miss the births. You're going to miss those first Christmases with your kids. But it's either what you have now or what I'm going to give you. Will you take it? And of course, I'd take it. But I would mourn missing it. Missing all those magical moments. So, just keep that in mind as you're tuning your world, as you're turning your reality, and you believe that it can be done. I've heard the life story of George Lucas and Steven Spielberg up from the point where they're about 12 years old to when they started making their first films. And the story of their stories are very similar. By the age of 12, both their fathers participated in their life and really got them video cameras and helped them make movies and that sort of thing. And for those of you like me, you lived a normal life. Your dad didn't do that because he had to work. You sort of go, damn, what would my life be if my dad was there for me like that? My dad worked so freaking hard. I never saw him. I mean, I saw him, but it was always like randomly. My dad did cool shit, man. Like, he'd come home and go, here's a motorcycle. You're 8. And you just learned how to ride a bike 6 months ago. Here's a motorcycle. And he just said, this is the way you use it. Go. And I was like, okay. And sure enough, like within 10 minutes, I had learned to learn how to ride a motorcycle. It's really pretty funny. But George Lucas the story about him is he's so monotone. Maybe he wasn't, but he seemed to be so monotone. It was sort of like he was a robot executing his life. And when you hear about Spielberg, it's a different game. That dude, I guess he was filming one of his first films, which I think is his, the film he made. God, I just gave the Kyle back, or gave Kyle back his movie on this, but it was one about a truck driver driving this truck and terrorizing everyone. Sort of a lesser version of the story, the movie called The Car, which, man, if you haven't seen The Car, it's a cheesy ass 70s movie, but in terms of cinematic reveal, man, is it just masterful. Back in the 70s, it was mind-blowing that they had this super evil car. The car is about the devil showing up in this utterly modified 65 Lincoln terrorizing this town in the middle of, like, Arizona or something, or New Mexico or something. And they don't reveal what the car looks like until halfway through the film, which you couldn't possibly do to the short attention span kids today, right? But Spielberg, they said in his first film... which, damn it, I wish I could remember the name of that. He was standing on top of a building, and they were doing a big cop chase through the town. And I think I got the movie right. But they said that when the shot commenced, and, you know, he's watching it, they said he was jumping up and down with joy on top of this rooftop. He's a really young kid. He's, like, in his early 20s, and he is flipping out that he gets to film a movie. And I've always... I hope that story is true. It's told by several people from different perspectives in the special I saw. But I always thought, good. He appreciated his life. And imagine you take that away from him and you say, okay, you've just shot E.T. and I'm going to zoom you to that point in your life. Well, now you've done Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., Poltergeist, first Indiana Jones, for God's sake. And you've lost those amazing moments because you move too damn fast through your life. So don't be afraid to go through the tuning of your life and experience all the in-betweens. Now, if you got cancer, we'll let you go as fast as you want to go. But that could probably be resolved pretty quickly based on my research. I know you feel me. I do not have my mind blown that often in this world for anything. And part of it's because I'm usually the guy that's hired to do it. When I used to work for Electronic Arts, one of the committees I worked on was the committee that approves new games that are brought into the company. People who are developing a game outside Electronic Arts, and they're bringing it in to get their last bit of funding or at least distribution through our company. And we used to have to sit there in these rooms and watch these games get presented to us. So, you know, sometimes the games were partially done, sometimes they were completely finished, and we just had to vote. And I was brought in on the internet level and eventually learned I had a good story eye and good design eye. So I just kept going in. And when you're in that capacity, you see amazing things constantly. And so getting your mind blown is a little hard after a while because you see everything. And you're like, oh yeah, that's like this other thing we didn't take. So when I get my mind blown, it's pretty huge. And this whole Eli Whitney being a white guy thing. Okay, Mandela effect people. I'm not one of you. Over the next month, I'm going to start talking about the Mandela effect to everyone I know, especially all these intellectuals that think they know. I'm going to be interested because I'm going to talk to some of my really astute friends. I haven't talked to them yet. And we'll just see what happens. Maybe I'll report back. But to the individual who reported this, I forgot your name. I don't have my phone on me to check. Thank you so much for posting that. I'll let you know in the comments before I post this that it's coming. And this episode is completely triggered by your paragraph of things. I was talking to one of our listeners, Richie, who's the incredible freaking artist. If you guys haven't been, well, first of all, make sure you go to facebook.com/deepthoughtsradio and hit the like button. One, you'll get the feed of this, which you probably already get through YouTube, but our listeners in that channel, there's about 67 people there. We have over like 600 and something over in the MKUltra thing, which is very political and acidic, in my opinion. We try to keep it funny, but it's hard too when you're dealing with those other subject matters. But Richie's posted this. He's just an incredible freaking artist. He does these beautiful isometric illustrations. You got to get into it. But I was talking to him, and you know, we're both kind of going back and forth, sort of with our jaws on the ground about the world. You know, and the funny thing about Flat Earth is that I salute people like Eric, what is it, Eric Dubé, I think is his name. He's one of the big flat earthers. Mark Sargent, big flat earther. That they have just dealt with it enough that they're like, yes, it's flat. I know it sounds nuts, but I have now concluded in my brain that it's flat. I don't know what it is or where it is or any of that kind of stuff, but it's flat. I think Eric has a more advanced opinion about the subject matter, and good for him. But most of us are still going, do you really think it's flat? You know, do I think you're crazy or do I think you're brilliant? Because it's sort of like walking the fine line of that whole thing. All I can say is, for me personally, well, I say two things. I say the Flat Earth folks have definitely got my attention. Precession. The bullshit about the fact that the North Pole is average degree of 4 degrees Fahrenheit and the South Pole is 60 degrees below Fahrenheit when they're actually located exactly at the same location on a ball. That between winter and summer for the northern and southern hemispheres, there's the same amount of sun exposure on both sides of those locations on the surface of the planet, but they don't melt away. And why would the North be a shitload warmer, 56 degrees warmer than the South Pole? Doesn't make any sense. Eric Dubé posted the, you know, again, the log of those guys that sailed around the South Pole. One guy giving up after 40,000 miles and one guy finishing it, I believe, at 53,000 miles. It can't be that big around, people, if it's an island. It just can't. So either Dubé's lying or those dudes were telling the truth and we got to rethink this whole game. But now with the Mandela effect permanently locked in my brain as being real, what I want to finish with is what I told Richie. I said, look, I said, I feel like, regardless of what it is, I feel safe. I feel safe, and that makes me feel good. I mean, I feel really safe. And what do I mean by that? Does it mean I can't suffer? No, not at all. Get hit by a bus. You know, I had a buddy of mine, older guy, he... just to give you an idea of what randomly can occur to you, which a friend of mine I think is very real in this universe, not an NPC. He's walking home from a gym. He had dropped his partner off at the gym. He's walking home because he likes really long walks. And this dude was driving. I don't know what the hell the guy was. He was taking his drive from his home. And for some reason, in the early morning, he thought... he had taken the trip to drop his daughter off to school, but he didn't realize he was just mechanically driving to the school and not realizing his daughter wasn't in the car because there was no school that day. And so when he realized at the last second that he didn't have his daughter with him and he didn't have to drop his kid off, he takes an immediate left turn and hits my friend walking across the street with his car. So my buddy's walking. This guy hits him with his car. Breaks his left shin with the bumper. Bone sticking out of his leg, all right? That gross kind of pop. He now has a bar in his leg. This whole thing happened to him in his mid-60s. It was horrendous. So shit can happen, people. All I can say is, if you live in a metropolitan area and you're walking on foot, man, you need to be unbelievably paranoid. Because stuff can happen to you, right? So I don't think that we're safe in the realm of that, but I'll tell you what. I just definitely don't worry about death. I don't worry about it at all. At all. I think as long as you live a good, empathetic life, you do everything you possibly can to, one, live your life with all the tools and resources that you've had bestowed upon you by the universe, and you try to help people with those resources when you can, you're good. The circus and the show and the entertainment of existence goes into high gear when you die. It doesn't end. You know, you can mourn someone's death that you won't be able to talk to them, and you can definitely mourn the death of a young person who didn't get to live that life. That's where it really, where the emotions hit the pavement, right? But, you know, I'd say, you know, me personally, if something happens to me, well, you might miss me, but Believe me, I'm owning this motherfucker after it's over, right? I'm having a good time when it's over. I am prepared. I'll just tell you, I've got a list of things I want to do after this life, and I certainly hope I'm able to do it. I certainly hope there's something out there. But because I believe the universe is so fun, especially with this Mandela effect thing, it seems to be a lot more. It seems to be almost empirical proof that it's really pretty fun out there. It might be frustrating at times. Might be scary at times. But like I said, if it can't kill you on this planet, kill your mortal coil, that is. Probably safe here. And, you know, part of it's just riffing in my brain right now. I think that it's one of the reasons why I want to get our boys out of war. You know, support our troops by doing two things. Doing everything in your power to expose those who create the wars, and do everything in your power to enable the soldiers that go into these meat grinders to get home safely. It was a big deal back in 2003 that the military wouldn't outfit our soldiers with the proper armor, and like the vehicles weren't armored enough to handle IEDs. They didn't have enough body armor to survive a hit from a bullet. And so we wanted to get them, like families were having to pitch in money to help our soldiers. I think it's a little bit better now, if not a lot better. But we need to get our boys home on their sovereign soil that they were born on, at least that they live for. And we can do it by probably using the law of attraction and whatever mechanism enables this whole Mandela thing. So that's all I got for you on this special report. But I wanted to pump this out because I wanted to capture the energy and the feeling I'm having right now as a result of this Eli Whitney thing. Again, he was a black man when I was young. It was sold to me as a wonderful, wonderful moment of historical irony that a black man who was forced to pick cotton would create a machine to solve the problem. And it was also sold to me that how did a slave that had all of his education ripped out of his history, I mean, he didn't have his predecessors, his slave mother, father, probably back at least two generations, didn't have education in this country. And so this seemingly, to the white man of the time, the seemingly primitive African was not primitive. Obviously, he's part of the gene pool that built the frickin' pyramids. His recessive brilliance popped, and he made this machine. It's a mechanical thing. I remember them teaching us how the thing worked. You know, how it just through the law of attrition was able to strip away the cotton off of the branch, such that the branch had a certain consistency, and the cotton had a different consistency, and these little blades were able to tangle up the cotton and separate the branch from it. Huge. And now it's a white guy from Yale. Wow. MKUltraRadio.com. If you haven't been, for all the feeds, I think that's all I'm going to say today. I appreciate everyone coming in. I've been knocking these things out a lot faster. I'm pining for a couple new gigs, and when they arrive, I just may not have the time to do this. But I also learn my lesson in doing a bunch of these and letting them get backlogged and not having enough time to edit them. So I'm just throwing these things out there. Don't worry about watching them all at the same time, you know, watching them as soon as they come out. Obviously, no one really worries about that, but just leave them out there. So when you get a chance to get to them, you get to them, you enjoy, hopefully. I know that these things go on forever. I know I pontificate, as they say, but hopefully there's some value, you know, from one human being to another. So I appreciate you guys like you can't believe. And again, you guys just I don't even know if I've ever heard from this person before, but geez, you affected me, brother or sister, I don't know. But thank you so much. And all I'm just going to say is take care of yourself and somebody else. Law of attraction, baby. Let's fix this universe. Over now.